You're listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast from Judicial Watch.
I'm Chris Farrell, and this is On Watch. Welcome to On Watch, everybody, the Judicial Watch podcast, where we go behind the headlines to report on matters that the mainstream media would really rather that you not know about. We try to recover some lost history. We try to explain the inexplicable. We really appreciate you joining us, whether you're watching us on the video version of this podcast or listening to us on the audio streaming podcast platforms that are out there. We appreciate your time, and we appreciate you subscribing to the podcast, leaving us a rating, and letting us know what you'd like us to cover. Today, an incredibly great opportunity for us. We get to speak with investigative reporter for Alpha News, the one and only Liz Cowan. Liz, welcome to On Watch.
Chris, thank you so much for having me. It truly is an honor. I've been a fan from afar for a long time.
Liz, thank you so much. What we need to talk about today is your remarkable work producing a documentary entitled The Fall of Minneapolis. You've been a reporter for 20-some years. You moved from kind of, regional or big city Minneapolis television news over to Alpha News. Alpha News has just been booming. It's been taking off. It was kind of a niche news operation, but increasingly you're breaking headlines, breaking news, and really expanding the operation. Your work there, tied into or fed into your effort to produce this incredible documentary, The Fall of Minneapolis. Can you kind of give us a kickoff? Tell us what inspired it and how you got going doing this incredible documentary.
Thank you for the kind words about the documentary. Certainly appreciate that. I say that, you know, this is not a path that I ever planned, not really a part of the life plan, but sort of my backstory. I'm a Minnesota native myself, kid who grew up with a dream of being on television, being a television reporter, kind of from the time I was 5 or 6 years old. I really kind of became obsessed a bit with the industry, but I landed, you know, what I considered my dream job back in 2008. I was working at the CBS affiliate in Minneapolis, where I worked for nearly 14 years, but sort of climbed the ranks there. My reporting led to laws being changed in Minnesota. I won a bunch of Emmy Awards. I was a very popular anchor on the weekends, and really saw the left come after me in the wake of all of this the George Floyd situation in Minneapolis, because I was married. I still am married to the guy, but he was a longtime Minneapolis police lieutenant at the time, Bob Kroll, and he was serving as the Minneapolis Police Federation president, the union president, right, of the Minneapolis Police Department at this time. So I kind of had this unique perspective, not only being married to a Minneapolis police officer, but also as a journalist. And I was really struck with that part of things, with how the media refused to really report the truth about this from the very beginning. I was not allowed to report on the situation at all, but you know, the cancel culture came after me, came after my husband, and I just didn't feel that the truth had ever been reported here, which led me to team up with Dr. J.C. Shea is his name, and he helped put out the book that we did, They're Lying: The Media, the Left, and the Death of George Floyd. And that was last year, and that's what then led to this crowdfunded documentary, The Fall of Minneapolis, that we released in November, just in a way to set the record straight. But I think more than anything, to go back to the people who lost their voice in all of this, because it truly did seem that nobody cared about the truth.
So this is really, you've hit this from a couple of different angles. There's the book that you wrote called They're Lying, which I guess really is the foundation for the subsequent documentary film. And so they're kind of hand in glove or partner pieces. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, I was the one, which is funny, because I obviously have no experience with being an author at all, sort of pushing for the book, because I just felt, you know, there's so many documents here we need and right, interviews and such. And Dr. Shea had been behind some books before to help with that. And then he's the one who said, you know what, you're actually a TV reporters, we should probably take this a step further after the book, because so many people did come forward after the book that were willing to speak and to be on camera, which obviously can be something that makes people a bit nervous. But I
Sure.
think it sort of gave people the courage to come forward to do the documentary.
So I think even the title of the documentary film itself is interesting, because obviously the sort of the proximate cause or the foundation for the entire documentary is the death of George Floyd. But really the title describes the much larger picture, which is the fall of Minneapolis. And so just expand on that. It could give our viewers a sense of how the misreporting and the lying about the death of a guy with a very serious violent criminal history who essentially overdosed on fentanyl, how his death becomes contorted and distorted into the collapse of an entire city. Walk us through that, please.
Yeah, I think that in the early stages as this unfolded, and I'm talking, you know, within hours and in the very early days when the rioting ensued and such, you could tell how messaging was manipulated, not only by the media, but, you know, I call them kind of so-called leaders in Minnesota, because we certainly did not see much leadership after all of this. So this kind of starts for me, realizing that the police training manual is mysteriously, 2 pages of it are missing online in the very early days, when you have the police chief and the mayor talking about how, you know, whatever Derek Chauvin is doing and these other officers are doing, it's not a part of police training, you know, one of many lies. The very first time that body camera footage is withheld from the public. In fact, it's nearly 2.5 months before it's leaked through an international news agency. And I think that's why we wanted to put out this body camera footage, because I do feel that if they just would have went ahead and brought this forward, as they do with any critical incident in Minneapolis, it's the whole reason, you know, police officers wear
four body cameras. Exactly.
Yeah. It's the whole point of it, right? All they talk about is transparency. But again, that never had happened before, that they withheld that video. You also have the FBI being called in within just a few hours of that viral Facebook video that was posted online. So there's all these things happening very early on. But you're right, here we are, you know, more than 3 years later at this point, and we're all of us, I think, across the country are paying the consequences for those lies that were told right here in Minneapolis. You know, crimes that never happened before in Minneapolis and in other places, frankly, happening in record numbers. No matter what they tell you, I mean, we're all really less safe, you know, as a result of those lies.
So you have the death of George Floyd, and certainly no one would celebrate or in any way say that his death is a good thing, just the opposite. And there's been a lot of false characterizations surrounding his death, generally speaking, but it's a tragedy all unto itself, in large part, I believe, because of his own conduct. His behavior and his conduct, overdosing on fentanyl, is the foundation for how this entire thing even unfolds or how it transpires. There's a lot of other people around it, but really, in the end, it's George Floyd and his conduct and his behavior, and there's a sort of a natural consequence that comes from that. And there's a coroner's report to document it. It's not a matter of opinion. It's a scientific fact, you know, concluded by medical professionals. The thing that gets to me is when you watch your documentary and you see the lies, the manipulation, the political grandstanding, the decisions to do things that place the police in jeopardy, you know, the insanity of surrendering a police precinct to violent mobs. Who benefits from this? I mean, who is behind this? This is a deliberate, thoughtful decision-making process where various politicians at the city, whether it's the mayor, the governor, they went through a process, a procedure practically. Who's directing that? Who's orchestrating that? And who benefits? Because it's outside the norm of any other situation where there's, you know, a protest or there's urban violence. Who is behind it? Who's advancing this?
Yeah, these are all great questions, Chris. And I think with any reporting, you know, if you follow the money, you follow the power. You'll get at some answers there. I think that it can't really be overlooked. This is a presidential election year that this took place. You know, thinking back to 2020, you have chaos that sort of ensued as a result of COVID. You know, the lockdowns, and then obviously the rioting that spread all across the world, not even just in this country. But there is actually quite a bit of documentation who's funneling the defund the police movement. You know, that's been documented here in the Minneapolis area. George Soros spent a great deal of money, right, helping to fund that situation. They went ahead and voted in favor of not defunding the police. But I think one would argue that of course, they've been defunded. You have a police force that was nearly 900 strong before all of this in early May of 2020. That's dwindled now to 500. But also, I think, you know, the media plays a very pivotal role in this. I obviously was a member of the mainstream media for nearly two decades. I'd certainly seen a change in my last few years, not so much what we were telling the public, but what we were not. I think that this documentary is a great example of that. Nearly 7 million, actually, I think more than 7 million people have viewed the documentary, The Fall of Minneapolis, so far. Not one mainstream media station has yet to even mention it.
Just pause there for a second. 7 million views, and the coverage in the mainstream media, not for lack of merit, not for lack of, you know, the journalistic value of the film, but not one of the mainstream media outlets will even talk about it. I mean, they won't interview you and say, "Hey, you did a documentary. Tell us why." I mean, that speaks volumes. That's the foundational problem to this, is that the American public, one problem is the politicians are lying. The other part of the problem is the media, by failing to report, malinforms the public in this kind of way. And that's really tragic, because people need to see the work that you've done.
Well, thank you, Chris. And actually, I will say that many people, I've received so many emails, just different comments on social media and such, that they're angry that this information was withheld from them, because they think very differently about all of this now. Again, you have this very dangerous and divisive narrative peddled in the wake of all of this, all about racism and this white police officer, you know, basically crushing the neck of this black man in the middle of the street, in the middle of the day. I mean, it's horrific. Nobody thinks that the video, looks at anything. But there is certainly so much more to this story that we were not told. And I've received, as I said, quite a bit of feedback, a lot of people who are, you know, Democrats or admit to, you know, being on the left, and they're upset about the lies that were told, too, because they were led to believe one thing, and they feel very, very differently now.
I just want to walk people through some concepts that in my past life, in my misspent youth, many, many years ago, I was both a counterintelligence officer and a clandestine human intelligence case officer. And so I've dealt with things like subversion. In fact, way, way, way long ago, in the days of the Cold War, the Army had a program called Subversion and Espionage directed against the Army. And one of the things that people do to engage in subversion, or the destabilization of a government, is that there's a number of processes. And when I mention a few things that I'm going to run down this list with for you, I'd like you to glom onto one or two of them and explain how that transpired, or how that manifested in Minneapolis with regard to the George Floyd incident. You know, there's this effort on the part of people like BLM and Antifa to engage in something called revolutionary defeatism, where they actually foster and create this defeatist, sort of lost, destabilizing effort to demoralize the public and to demoralize the police officers. So this revolutionary defeatism also feeds into this idea, and this is more of a psychological term, of learned helplessness, where people know that there's nothing they can do, even though they're right in the middle of it, and they actually can do something about it, but they just feel defeated by it and overcome. There's a certain psychological conditioning that goes on for the public, where they're fed a steady sort of propagandistic line And after a while, even though they know better, they accept a falsehood. And really, this all feeds into or creates a crisis mentality. And that crisis is eventually resolved. I mean, Minneapolis did return to normalcy, but that normalcy is anything but normal. It's accepted as the new normal. And everything I've just talked through in the last minute or so is really, it's a revolutionary, subversive process where usually the militant left, and in this case, BLM, Antifa, et cetera, they use this as a technique. They change the country. And I think they succeeded in doing so in Minneapolis. I know that was a ton of sort of terminology and technique I just threw at you. My apologies. But I think it's important that people realize none of this is an accident. None of this is, whoops, gee, it just happened. It's not spontaneous. And I'll be quiet and let you take it from there.
No, I really think you hit the nail on the head here. And that's why I think many people have this reaction to the documentary, because I think they're waking up a bit in the fact that, you know, there's a lot more at work here, than we were told. And that I think should scare people. I think Alex King talks about that, in great length in the documentary as well. Again, he's the black officer who arrested George Floyd, but his narrative did not fit the situation. So he was sort of dismissed. But here he is. Now he's going to be a lifelong felon after serving several years in prison, being on his third day on the job as a Minneapolis police officer. And he's caught up in all of this. But you're right. Fear certainly permeated the air in Minneapolis. And I think, frankly, it still does in the wake of a lot of this. So you have people sort of cowering to the mob. You can't speak up because you are a racist or a sexist, or, you know, you're all of those things. You're tied to white supremacy. But the evidence here didn't support any of that at all. But I would say that they were very successful, the left. And I think also, you can't underplay here the so-called leaders we have in charge in Minnesota, really the perfect people in the perfect positions for this to play out, whether it's the Attorney General of Minnesota, Keith Ellison, who has a long history of not only representing gang members as an attorney, but a long history of hating the police, an Antifa supporter publicly. You have Governor Tim Walz, who held back the National Guard for days to allow the rioting to continue. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, who I think the evidence shows lied about this case over and over again. But again, I think all of these people, certainly were very vocal, but many people, you're right, I think could have done more, but silence sadly ruled the day.
So there's one other instance I want to point to, and that is sort of the manipulation and the suppression of evidence and the effort to sort of carve out a narrative legally within the context of the court trial itself, the actions of prosecutors, the actions of judges, and folks that subscribe to this podcast will remember just a couple of weeks back, we talked about the Gretchen Whitmer FedNapping case, where these guys were put on trial, and again, all sorts of evidence constrained, thrown out, not allowed to be seen, actually evidence manufactured, stuff out of thin air. And, there's this instance in Michigan, which is a travesty, and folks should go back and watch that if they haven't seen it. And then there's this case here with Judge Cahill and how he managed his courtroom and how he allowed or disallowed certain evidence to come in. Give our viewers a chance, or give them an insight, really, into how compromised that entire court process was in Minneapolis.
Yeah, and that was difficult to kind of boil that down, even for the documentary. I will say there's a lot more about the case itself in the book. They're lying, but really many would call them very questionable rulings made by Judge Peter Cahill, who is still serving in Hennepin County. In a way, it seems the script was written long before Derek Chauvin's trial began, 10 months after the death of George Floyd. But you have 14 pages of jury instructions that go to that jury. A typical case would, you know, be a one or two page document. You have a jury that's not sequestered. Not only that, but they are, you know, basically paraded in and out of this courtroom that has barbed wire around it, National Guardsmen on duty, people out protesting each and every day. But I think that there are some rulings that people were not aware of before the documentary, including how this MRT training was not allowed in trial. And again, this is what Derek Chauvin and the officers were doing. It's on body camera, on the body camera videos themselves, openly talking about MRT, something that had been in place for decades within the Minneapolis Police Department, but mysteriously goes missing, you know, from the online document. But Judge Peter Cahill ruled that there was no proof that Derek Chauvin signed his name in to the last time MRT, the maximal restraint technique, was taught in front of the Minneapolis police officers. So that's why he went ahead and decided that that training slide showing basically exactly, you know, what the officers were doing that was not allowed to be seen by the jury. Just, I think, a pretty critical piece of information. Not only that, but the chief of police and the head of the Minneapolis police training unit, Katie Blackwell, who has since been promoted. Everybody gets a promotion. That's how this story ends.
The more you lie, the higher your promotion goes. We have the case of Lieutenant Byrd here in Washington, D.C., who shot and killed Ashley Babbitt. He got a medal and promotion to captain. I mean, this is what happens across the board.
No, and I think that, again, Alex King speaks to this in the documentary. You know, are we okay with this as you know, United States citizens, that the mob rules our judicial system? Is there a justice system anymore? And I think these are the questions we need to grapple with. And I think, you know, as you bring out, Chris, there are so many examples of this playing out in courtrooms all across the country.
I'm gonna let you close with sort of a thought of looking ahead. So you've done the book, you've done the movie. But now what happens? Now, you know, a frustrated public that has little or no faith in the law enforcement and judicial system, or at least, let's put it this way, the fabric has been kind of shredded, right? It's a very corrosive environment. Liz, as we close out, what's your view looking forward? Where do we go? How does this play out?
Yeah, you know, I wish I had the crystal ball here. It does seem certainly people are waking up, but sadly this takes another tragic turn just 9 days after putting out the documentary. You have Derek Chauvin, who has been in this facility in Tucson, Arizona, without any incident, a federal facility, I should mention, who's stabbed 22 times by a former FBI informant. So there's much more to come when it comes to that, as he slowly works to recover. So it's sort of like, you know, more chapters seem to be written here, but I think that, you know, even putting this out, I was hopeful that, you know, somebody would step forward. Perhaps a lot of people have offered their help and services, but I really think that, you know, the legal system is what's going to have to help here. But again, these officers pled guilty, the other three, after seeing what happened in Derek Chauvin's trial. So they are, you know, in prison anywhere from 3 to 5 years. So there's still a long road ahead.
Liz Callen, producer of The Fall of Minneapolis, investigative reporter with Alpha News, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Chris Farrell, On Watch.
Thanks for listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.